Morning, FSB staff. We are going to proceed with review recognition with an educational session. Addison?
Thanks, Hans. Actually, today, so we have three papers to discuss this month, and over the next sort of hour and 45, we'll discuss all three. Paper 7A is it's a joint paper with the FASB on credit card arrangements, and so today we'll just be having an ISB education session. Paper 7B and 7C are ISB-only papers, so we'll discuss those as a decision-making session today. I think if it's all right with everyone, we'll start with paper 7B and 7C, which Natasha will tee up. But maybe just before I turn it over to her, just to let you all know where we are. This month represents sort of where we are in terms of the revenue recognition project. So this month represents sort of the last of the issues that we identified during the redeliberations period. We are, as we said in sort of February, we are substantially complete our redeliberations, and we're very much in the drafting process now. Just as per usual, we're continuing to evaluate whether there's any sweep issues that need to come back to the board, but nothing unusual at this time. So unless you have any questions, I think I'll turn it over to Natasha to tee up paper 7B, which is IFRS 1 and IS 8.
So agenda paper 7B addresses two issues related to transition. The first one is for transition for first-time adopters, and the second is the applicability of disclosures required by paragraph 28F of IAS 8 to entities who already apply IFRSs and use the retrospective transition method. So first, we'll look at the first-time adopters, which is in paragraphs 10 to 17. In February 2013, the boards decided to provide existing IFRS preparers with the option to use either their retrospective transition method with the proposed practical expedience from the 2011 ED or an alternative transition method. In the 2011 ED, the practical expedience offered to ease the burden of retrospective application, which are listed in paragraph 6 of the paper, were also offered to first-time adopters. The boards decided to retain these practical expedients in February, and respondents did not comment on the applicability of the practical expedience to first-time adopters, so the staff do not think it is necessary for the board to redeliberate the application of those expedients to first-time adopters. However, the alternative transition method, a cumulative catch-up method, was decided upon by the boards in February as an option available to existing IFRS preparers. As such, the staff are now asking the board if they would like this option to be available for first-time adopters. As described in paragraphs 10 to 14 of the paper, the staff think it would be complicated and burdensome for first-time adopters, in part because of the two reconciliations of equity that would be required. Because of this, the staff recommend that the board does not amend IFRS 1 to permit first-time adopters of IFRSs to use the alternative transition method, as outlined by the boards in February, to transition to the revenue standard. This is question 1 in the paper. However, in paragraphs 15 to 17 of the paper, the staff have analyzed another possibility for relief, which would be broadening the practical expedient in paragraph C3 of the 2011 ED to include contracts completed under legacy revenue requirements before the earliest comparative period presented. For the reasons outlined in paragraph 17, the staff recommend that the board does not provide an exemption for first-time adopters to ignore in their application of IFRS 1 contracts that are completed under legacy revenue requirements before the earliest comparative period presented, i.e. before the date of transition to IFRSs. This is question 2 in the paper. I'll now turn it over to the boards for discussion.
I have perhaps a wrong question, but anyhow. What will happen in U.S.? Will they be without being first-time adopter into this standard, or because I mean they have a lot of different ways of accounting, so
So are you asking your question today, Jan, so not sort of IFRS adoption, just how they will adopt this standard?
Will we do the same thing international and US GAAP?
Yes, that's right, for existing preparers.
So they will have the same, they will not be considered first-time adopters into this standard?
No, because this will be US GAAP.
Then I think there must be many other countries who have a similar situation. And I think we should be more generous than what you're proposing.
A similar situation.
Like the Americans.
Well, but it's because the Americans are adopting this as US GAAP.
Yeah.
So there are existing preparers that are adopting this standard for the first time, like existing IFRS preparers.
So the normal transition applies. So the normal transition applies.
That's right.
So we've discussed the reliefs for transitioning from either US GAAP or IFRS to the new revenue standard. You've already reached that decision set. This is about transitioning from a local GAAP to IFRS, is taking into account the new revenue standard.
Yeah. I'm open to be more generous.
Doug?
Yes. Yeah, thank you. First of all, I would like to thank staff for bringing this up to board table. I appreciate that. However, I'm quite disappointed with your proposal.
That's off nicely.
Yeah.
Yeah, just ignore it.
I think this is because I found a lot of inconsistency in your proposal. Inconsistency number one, I think we have been saying that we are going to give same relief to the first time adopter, but your proposal is inconsistent with what we have been saying. So you are not going to give any relief to the first-time adopters. That's number one, inconsistency. And the other, second inconsistency is, according to your paper, paragraph 17B says, under current IFRS 1, current IFRS 1 does not provide similar relief. So that is why staff is not going to propose relief. But then why do we propose alternative transition method to the existing IFRS preparers? Perhaps this is because our new standard is much more complicated than the IS 18 and the IS 11. Therefore, it is quite hard for preparers to make a retrospective adjustment. Because in our standard, there are some incremental additional information is necessary to make a retrospective adjustment, and they say it's quite difficult. That's why we are giving alternative transition method. So this is inconsistent to the first-time adopters. And the third inconsistency is about the strategic inconsistency. So we have been trying to lower the hurdle of IFRS 1 so far. We are giving deemed cost and giving up IFRS 21 cumulative OCIs, whatever. So this is because the lowering hurdle of IFRS 1, we can get more IFRS company, which will contribute to the transparency in the end. So eventually, by increasing the IFRS preparers, we will increase the transparency. Of course, by lowering hurdle of IFRS 1, we may lose some comparability of transition. However, this is more transparent than keeping them in the outside of IFRS, keeping them in local GAAP. Therefore, we have been lowering the hurdle of IFRS 1. I think your proposal itself is inconsistent to our strategy so far. And for example, in Japan, more than 40 prominent companies are now seriously preparing to move to IFRS, but they have not announced when. The reason why they have not announced is because they are watching our revenue project to complete. So actually, your proposal is really disincentivizing them to move to IFRS earlier. So in this sense, I do disagree with the proposal. And because of this disappointment to staff's proposal, last night in Tokyo, stock exchange Nikkei fell 7%. So I strongly disagree with your proposal.
So Doug, this really undermined your whole. It's
the error of course.
Clearly, all an exaggeration.
7.1, right? Right. So market foresee so long.
Speak now. There you go.
A question about question two. You know, the still not so clear, you know, to ignore those contracts completed before the comparative period or not, you know, whether we have such a huge difference, I will be willing to ignore.
What would you be willing to ignore?
The full retrospective application means you will retrospectively apply to the standards to all the transactions as if the standards established long time ago. But for those transactions already completed before comparative period, we won't apply to those transactions. My question is, what difference will create to apply to the comparative period if you ignore or not?
Well, I think, and maybe Darian and Tasha can chime in as well, but I think, you know, it's unclear to us exactly the effect because we don't know what the revenue standards are that people are transitioning from because it's IFRS 1, so they could be any number of revenue standards that they're transitioning from. And I think that's what we mentioned in paragraph 17A of the paper. But I think the reason why we brought this up is because it does give some relief to people to not need to consider those contracts that may be completed before the earliest comparative period.
In the past, when we sometimes discuss these issues, one reason I can see the benefit, but I not agree with, that is in some countries, security regulator require 5-year summary, you know, more than 1 or 2 years comparative period, then people will say that, you know, if we ignore the transaction complete before the end of, before the comparative period, then the, you know, summarized amount will not be comparable. But, you know, my basic, you know, idea is to ignore seems, you know, it makes sense, but you say it's not clear. What kind of area you feel unclear? I'm not so clear.
Well, I mean, so for example, under an entity's local gap in their legacy in their current country before they moved to IFRS, they might have had contracts that they thought were all point in time sale of goods. So they were so recognizing all of the revenue on the day that they sold the goods to the customer. Whereas if you were to apply a revenue model, we might say, well, actually, that's a performance obligation satisfied over time, or there are other performance obligations that you still need to account for in the future under our improved revenue model. Now, if you say you can ignore all of those closed contracts at a time before your date of transition to IFRS, it means that all of those contracts that happened before your earliest comparative year, you won't get any revenue flowing through into the next years for those.
What do you mean completed?
As in, completed under your legacy gap. No, you've
completed.
No, we've defined it. Yeah, under the previous gap, you've recorded all of the revenue related to that contract. I think that's how we define completed contracts for transition.
But if that is the case, can we find some ways to capture those transactions? You know, I understand your point, you know, but for other transactions, you know.
But not sure how you'd identify that subset. I mean, I think what Gary's highlighting
is... truly completed it under...
Gary's highlighting a very typical example, I think, where you could get this difference, which is, you know, a lot of people do treat, you know, what we would treat as basically being a multiple element arrangement, i.e. a product plus a service, essentially just being the product. and would just accrue a cost at the point of sale when they recognize the revenue for the cost, we would now say there's also a service obligation in there. And so I think that's a common situation where they would deem the contract closed under their legacy GAAP, their local GAAP. And if you restate it in accordance with IFRS 1 with the new revenue standard, you'd have a remaining performance obligation on that. But, you know, as Alison said, the difficulty you have is that we can't possibly contemplate every scenario because we don't know what all those scenarios are. So, you know, that's why the staff has recommended what it has, which is that you restate retrospectively. But this is the additional, in question two, this is the additional extra relief that we think you could possibly consider. We've rejected it, but you could consider it. We would struggle to think of any other additional relief that you could apply to a first-time adopter without significantly changing the principle of IFRS 1.
Now, Harry, if I agree your concern, but you know, we have a few examples, you know, which may arrive at different numbers based on different principles, but we accept the relief. For example, you know, Tucker mentioned the deemed cost. Mm-hmm. You know, I still remember about 5 years ago, after Canada decided to move to our environment, and they raised four areas for relief. We decided to accept three of them. One of them is, you know, their oil gas company, even though operate in different places, but their accounting centralized. As a result, there are no, you know, bookkeeping record about PPE applied to individual asset. But based on our standards, we have to do so. But they ask relief, you know, whether we can give them relief, you know, not ask them to recreate the book. And we agree, you know. And I think, you know, the other areas I feel hard, but for those completed transactions, I feel some sympathy. And secondly, what's our decision on leasing standards? I forgot the first-time adoption.
We haven't actually, from memory, I don't think we've got anything specific.
Is there any relief?
And there are, remember, there are some reliefs carried forward from the 2011 ED for revenue. So there are some reliefs when you're doing the retrospective restatement, particularly around variable consideration.
And for example, you know, I forgot the first time adopter or not, but one of the important relief we give in the leading standards is, you know, not required to leafing out the numbers, which, you know, in the past you use financing lease model, but you can also say, you know, since we now have a new environment, we may result in different classifications as a result, different accounting. And I have sympathy on the completed transaction. We should give relief.
PK?
Couple of things I want to say in relation to the comment that Jan made about sympathy. On an emotional grounds, it does sound like we have to sound on par with what's given to existing IFRS preparers. But I think there are some very distinct differences that we need to respect. If we go down the Jan's approach, then suppose in 2017 a country adopts IFRS from some other local GAAP. So in the January 1, 2017, for the year ending December 31st, 2017, they will have IFRS 14. I'm giving a number, new revenue recognition standard. And the comparative year, which is 16, will be under local GAAP. Is that what you guys want?
No. Beginning of the earliest comparative.
I'm sorry?
Beginning of the earliest comparative period.
Yes.
Under the if I just use the alternative that was given to others, it will be 16 under the local GAAP.
You're doing Adam 1.
Yes,
yeah,
but.
I'm looking at Jan's question as question 1, right?
Yes, but in the current year, you also show the effect of the new standard in the current year. So you have comparability of that additional information with the preceding years.
So hang on. So it's not the other thing we need to think about. In my mind, is that IFRS 1, we are looking at the principles of IFRS 1. We are not looking at the principles of IFRS 14 that we are going to issue. The IFRS 1 principle says that in general it's retrospective unless we give. So on that basis, I support the staff on question 1 that we cannot go down to that. So you go down to the question 2. That's a relevant question. Perhaps it can be on the table, not off the table, to think about it. But think a little bit other than the Nikkei dropping 7.1%. It's not 7%, though. It's 7.1. Other than that, think about it, though. If you really think about closed contracts that you should give exemption, and I think there is some merit to it, that we can think about that. But you still have to do IAS 37 in terms of trying to see what is the remaining obligation you have and look at it and to make a provision. So therefore, you need to still look at the closed contract to see how much is the remaining performance obligation, and you put it on the balance sheet.
What do you mean closed?
They are finished.
What do you mean closed?
But if they are finished but there is obligation left, you got to do IAS 37.
No, if the obligation is not finished.
Well, if obligation is not finished, then there is no revenue.
If you could have a warranty obligation.
If there's absolutely no obligation, then it will be closed under our new standard as well.
Yeah. Then there's no warranty.
To think.
Then you don't need to do anything. The question comes down is that it is closed under the old one and open under our standard. Then you need to think about IFRS 14, IAS 37. So think about it. It is not a carte blanche, or we forget closed contracts and we are done with it. There is other requirements. Other requirements go back and ask you to look at it. So I think when you do this, you got to be thinking about other aspects. It's not as simple as, yeah, forget closed contracts. The reason why we can forget the closed contracts under the existing IFRS to IFRS is because we presume that they have done IAS 37 in the existing situation.
But we must put this in proportion. I mean, we talk about most likely
in proportion. Otherwise, you have to go and do IAS. You have to give exemption.
Very limited volumes for specialized companies.
Listen, I personally believe this issue is overblown, especially for the 40 companies that Tak is mentioning in his country. I really think it's not an issue. I think Allison said a point that if I'm converting from Mali GAAP, Timbuktu GAAP, to this, you will give them the same exemption that you will give it to some other person. And I think we need to think a little bit more deeply. But if you all feel that we should do it, I'm not going to oppose to that, but I'm just saying that you're throwing a lot of principles to it. I think you have to think about it. I'll give you one example more to illustrate my point, and whatever you do, I will go with the majority. I have a contract. I sold a turbine to Indonesia, and I sold it 5 years before the adoption of the standard, the new before me getting onto IFRS. But it has a 15 years of maintenance thing. But under some local GAAP, it is considered to be a closed contract. So you guys will say it's a closed contract, and you do not need to open it under the new literature if you do that.
Not necessarily so. Necessarily. You could have a catch-up or kind of a guarantee through IS 37 and say, if, by the way, you still have obligations without revenue, then it is on onerous and you have to accrue for it.
Agreed. You put up an IAS 37 liability?
Yeah.
When you do the IAS 37 liability, what is that you need to do? Still read the contract? Still look at the remaining performance obligation.
Sure.
So the amount of work that is needed to get to revenue is not...
I don't know.
Yeah. It's not zero.
No, it's not zero.
It's not zero, right? So think about it. All that obligation is going through the balance sheet. You are never taking that into the income statement. And how is that informationally faithful if you have a revenue performance obligation, but you take it through balance sheet? You put an IAS 37 liability and all the costs are going to go through the balance sheet.
The general situation in IFRS 1. IFRS 1, you have a lot of liability that will pop up in the balance sheet through IAS 37, and that will go to equity and not to P&L.
Yeah, exactly. That's a tradition. That's what happens.
Yeah,
agreed, but under the existing IFRS 1, IAS 11 and IAS contracts are revisited, and if there is a remaining obligation, you bring it onto the thing and show it on the income statement.
Tak?
Yes, I just would like to respond what the PK said. I agree with what PK is saying. I think it is the correct observation. As long as we are not allowing relief to the IS 37, we need to go back and to scrutinize whether we have a liability or not. However, this is quite different to rectify, to retrospectively adjust revenue and to check the IS 37 liability is quite a different issue. Because in the case of revenue, it's a top line, so everything should be managed based on that top line, including employees' assessment and the division's allocation, whatever. So all these things are related to revenue, and this is ongoing, and they have to change the old system. But in the case of IS 37, of course, you have to revisit some closed contract, which is significant. But the notion itself is really different.
And I think that the point TAC is making, and it's a fair point, I think the IS 37 piece of it, if that's what you had to do, would be easier, because essentially it would largely be a prospective measurement that you could do at the date of transition to IFRS. Whereas because the revenue measurement of the performance obligation is an allocation, at least in theory, it requires you to go right back to the beginning of the contract. So it is a fair point. It would be easier.
But now, if we want to say so.
Ian first.
I understand the points that are being raised and the problems that might come up. And, you said it might have been taken point of time and you should be taking, I mean the opposite one would be even worse actually, if it should have been point of time and you're taking it over time, so you're going to be taking on revenue.
But in that case it would still be open, so and our revenue proposal would say this thing pretty close, so it's automatically catching.
But even if, even despite that, I've got quite a lot of sympathy for that proposal on 16, and I think it would be, I don't think it'll make a great difference to the reporting, but I think it'll make a great difference to the amount of work that has to be done by at this time of day.
May go? Back to the logic, those who favor no exemption at all. What's our decision on the first-time adopter on this issue? All the complete transaction.
We give for alternative.
It's the alternative transition method would allow people to ignore contracts that have been completed before, for example, 1 January 2017. So anything in the comparative period or earlier.
So
under the alternative transition method.
Then whether we make irrational decision that time?
No step back, Steve.
Well, I think that was your decision.
You see, it seems you give a larger population of entities relief, not give Japanese entity relief. Am I right?
Well, I think some of the rationale for the alternative transition method is that we know that they're either transitioning, and this is what Henry was talking about earlier, is that we know that they're transitioning from either U.S. GAAP or IFRS, so they're known quantities. And that's the reason for the decision, as well as sort of the additional relief that the alternative transition method will provide for.
Yeah, simply other areas I didn't try to think about. But for those completed transactions, I have sympathy.
Mary?
With respect to question one, I agree with the staff recommendation to not provide the same relief that's available to existing IFRS entities, because I think the level of disconnect that would present in statements that were first-time adoption statements is inconsistent with what we're trying to do, and adding on another layer of reconciliation to me just muddles the communication value of the first-time adoption. But like some of the others speaking today, I have a lot more sympathy with the relief that's described in paragraph 16. And when I think about kind of the risk reward, I think I would make it, I would permit what you describe of not requiring restatement of contract completed under legacy revenue recognition. I wouldn't prohibit it, so I'd allow an entity to elect to do full restatement, not on contract by contract, but you know, one or the other. I think you know, a company will have to consider its trend reporting. In effect, if it's completed under previous GAAP but would not be under IFRS, it's a question of whether it has an opportunity to to report more revenue in the future. That you know, that will make companies think about whether it's worth the effort, both for a top line and for trend and consistency going forward. And they can weigh the costs and benefits of that. But I think the reminder about the applicability of, for example, 37 in terms of calculating an obligation for any remaining costs, is an important complement. So I don't see the same kind of risks, and I would support the proposal that's in 16.
And I like what you said there, Mary. I think it is a reminder to do that, rather, because effectively you obviously should be picking that up as part of IFRS 1 anyway. But I think that's absolutely right.
Chang-Wu?
Yes. Thank you. I'm wondering on tax point, you are suggesting, Mary just finished his explanation. You are saying if we permit that the alternative method, then that's more challenging for first-time preparers. But tax is saying that's not true. So I'm just confused. Which one is right? You know, 3 points, tax just raised before, but generally I felt that's burdensome for preparers in first-time adopters. But you are saying we are actually saving their burden by not permitting this alternative transition method. It's just the opposite opinion. So please clarify.
Sure. I think what we were thinking is that a first-time adopter has to restate their comparative period anyway for all of the other IFRSs. And so to require them to restate their comparative period for everything but revenue, and this is touching on a little bit what sort of Mary was saying, and I think we have a bit in the paper, so they'll have to do a reconciliation in equity in that comparative period, and they'd have a mixed presentation of IFRS for everything except revenue, and this is what PK was touching on. And then they'd transition to revenue in their sort of most recent, their first IFRS reporting period. And they'd have to do another reconciliation. And to us, that seemed quite challenging. I think Mary's use of the word muddling, sort of the transition to IFRS 1, I think to us that seemed, a very fair statement. And that's why we thought it would be burdensome.
But I think what Tuck was saying is, tell me if I'm wrong, is Tuck's looking more at what's in paragraph 16 of the paper. So I don't think Tuck's disagreeing with us that to apply the alternative transition method is confusing, but you did.
You said there are inconsistencies.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But also just one other point, Tuck, you said about that we always said it would be the same relief for first-time adopter. I would just like to push back on that because I don't think the board had agreed that. And effectively, the reliefs, there was a discrepancy between the reliefs in the previous ED. And I think the general, I sense the mood is going to sort of, around question two, which is absolutely fine. But, IFRS 1 has always said that a transition to IFRS is a major event. It's done in a very organized, methodical way. And that was the premise behind IFRS 1 about why, effectively, it said that none of the transition reliefs in the existing standards apply unless they're specified. So that there always has been that in IFRS 1 versus the transition requirements from existing preparers.
So can I ask a question about the two things in question 1 and 2? Is the completed contract relief different from the question 1 alternative transition method, or is it a subset of?
I think the completed contract relief is inherent in the alternative transition method, but there's another piece of relief in the alternative transition method, which is the relief from restating the comparative period. So question 2 does not provide relief from the comparative period. and effectively moves the line back for the completed contract relief to be before the earliest comparative period.
At the beginning, Mary of, the, said, at the beginning of the earliest comparative period.
At the beginning, yes.
Mary said that there may be a disincentive for doing the completed contract relief because you lose revenue the scenario that PK got. Would it be true to say that whilst you lose revenue, you actually gain in future revenue growth?
Yes.
Yes.
True.
Yes. In my mind, that creates a big incentive to do it.
Exactly.
Because you dismiss the reduction in revenue on transition as just those stupid accounting standard setters, and then you stay silent about the higher revenue growth and, hey, yeah,
you'll get a hockey stick. You'll get a hockey stick.
So I think that's a big problem with granting that complete contract.
Clark is fully aware of that.
Which is also a big problem in the alternative transition method.
But there at least you've got the disclosure in the current year of what it would have looked like under your
You do system. Have that disclosure, which is at least...
But
it's only for 1 year, which is a problem.
Yeah, but be careful, though. That disclosure tells you, if I understand correctly, that disclosure tells you what would have been the revenue under the old GAAP in the thing. It's not, I didn't want to counter Philippe that time. The current year, in the year of adoption under the alternative, the revenue reconciliation is to go back and put up the old numbers under the old GAAP. So that is not the idea. The effects is to recast the old income statement. So that means you will continue, my example, Mali GAAP revenues for 2 years.
But PK, on transition, when we have a complex situation, and we experienced it in 2005, when we all moved to IFRS, you have either a choice of restating totally your past, full retrospective, which is sometimes very difficult, or to accept that in 1 year, which is a bridge year, you have a new system that takes place, which is not comparable to the old one, and the only way you can restate some continuity in the comparability is to present that year under the new GAAP with information about what it would have been under the old GAAP, and then this is the point where people switch to the new system and they have a new starting basis. I think that's what is proposed here to a certain extent.
But I think the point that Steve made, and I had a lengthy conversation with the talk, is the same exact point, that if you do under the old GAAP, if you make a completed contracts, you will get a hockey stick revenue and it looks like your business suddenly improved. I had a lengthy conversation with Thak on that, and you'll screw up the trend information.
But in the case of hockey stick you are talking about, if you restate, you will enjoy the revenue twice.
It's not twice, though.
That's inherent in any change in accounting policy. Yeah.
And also, it's not revenue under JGAAP too.
Yeah, but suppose if you have a closed contract in the legacy revenue standard, and you recognize all the revenue in the legacy accounting standard, and then you restate, reopen it, and then from year 2017, you would recognize revenue of overtime basis.
But
you have recognized revenue in the past.
Revenue trend is based on the same GAAP, not on on different GAAPs.
Yeah, that's understandable. But
Maru, just would like to understand here what's really behind paragraph 13. We are talking about a set of first-time adopters, a specific subset of jurisdictions that didn't adopt IFRS yet. And paragraph 13 appears to concentrate in the challenging aspect of providing the additional information as a reconciliation or disclosure, and possibly confusing for investors, as you said here. So this is the case of, I'm seeing that, I'm not convinced that this is first a permission. So does it mean that a specific jurisdiction can, at the end of the day, even with our permission, not allow the adoption of this? First thing that I would like to draw the attention. Secondly, if it's a permission, the entity itself can, at the end of the day, decide that she will not use the relief that we are providing. And then this is the case, in my view, where I put this in the good complexity aspect. If I do believe this will be less burdensome for my jurisdiction of my or my company, and I do provide the appropriate level of disclosure about this, I don't see any problem, to be honest. I think we are anticipating effects that we are not sure they will happen, because we do not know the accounting environment in those countries in detail. We use it some here as reference. And at the end of the day, is a permission, and I don't see how can we anticipate that this will be challenging at a point that will not incentivize the companies to use it. We are allowing.
Okay, let's see what the outcome of this discussion is going to be. First, we have to answer question one, to not amend IFRS 1 to use for to permit first-time adopters to use the alternative transition method. Who agrees with that staff recommendation?
I agree.
For the first, I'd rather concentrate on question two.
Okay, then question two, which is the completed contracts relief for first-time adopters, who does not agree with the staff recommendation, or there is actually, the staff recommendation is not to provide an exemption. Who, let me put it in a positive way, who would like to give the exemption?
You got enough board.
I can't count.
Do you want to take the last question?
Yeah, question three.
So the second part of the paper, discusses paragraph 28F of IAS 8, which requires an entity to disclose the amount of adjustments to each financial statement line item affected in the current and prior periods as a result of applying a new IFRS. In September 2012, the board decided to consider whether this paragraph should apply on a standard-by-standard basis. The paragraph is only relevant for entities retrospectively applying the revenue standard. The staff think that this disclosure is not necessary for those entities for the current period because it would require entities to disclose the effect on the financial statements in the current year as if the entity had continued to apply legacy requirements. Users will already be able to obtain this trend information from the financial statements as presented under the retrospective transition method. Staff recommend that the board does not require entities to apply paragraph 28F of IAS 8 for the current period when the entity applies the retrospective transition method. Does the board agree with the staff recommendation?
Agreed.
Can I go?
No, Stephen?
This is fine. But so when somebody applies the alternative approach, they therefore do have to give it. My understanding is that this is something that's already required and is poorly complied with. So how do we ensure that somebody that's applying the alternative transition approach really does comply with it?
It's specified in our staff draft in the transition method.
So you're spelling it out. Yeah. Good.
That's right.
Having said that, agreed.
I'm just curious, the prior vote that I guess you got enough votes to change the staff recommendation, is the relief what you're describing in paragraph 16? Is that what the relief is going to be?
Yeah,
you were silent then what the relief was. It was just a question of, do you believe there should be relief? That's the relief?
But it was provided
that IS 37 would catch.
Yeah.
And provide for all onerous contracts under the new standard. If there is something left, a bit left, you would catch it through IS 37.
It's not onerous though. It's on liabilities.
Reminding
of the obligation.
The contract is completed, but under the new standard it's not, right?
And what disclosure goes with it? It's paragraph 16, what disclosure is provided?
I think it would be just your normal IFRS 1. We haven't specified a disclosure to go with this relief.
Any time you take an exemption under IFRS 1, you have to state the exemptions that you've taken. So someone would have to say, I took this revenue exemption, which means I didn't go back and restate my completed contracts.
Would that apply in the following year as well? Would you continue to provide that disclosure? Because the hockey stick could take place over several years.
I don't think so, Steve. The only transition to IFRS once, and that's why it's required.
But the impact of taking the relief is going to be over several periods.
But that would be adding additional disclosure from the existing IFRS 1 exemption.
It would be good disclosure.
Yeah, but it would require you to actually analyze the exact things that we told you.
That's the problem. I'd be very surprised if many companies elect this option. I think the market will demand the information. And the kind of companies that Tak is referring to are not the kind of companies that need the relief, in my view. They have the ability. So I'd be surprised. I think Mark will put a lot of pressure on companies not to avail themselves of the alternative approach.
But I think it'll be used opportunistically.
Sorry, did everyone agree to question?
Well, there was a solid majority.
Okay.
Okay,
shall
let's move on.
Shall we move on to paper 7C now? Is that, Tasha, do you want to tee that up?
So agenda paper 7C provides a summary of the mandatory and non-mandatory due process steps that the ISB has completed in developing the revenue project. It asks the board three questions relating to sufficient due process, re-exposure, and intent to defend. This paper marks the culmination of the ISB's due process project and asks the ISB for permission to ballot. The staff note that the FASB will complete their own due process analysis in the next few weeks and, in accordance with their own due process, will also be asked to provide permission for the FASB staff to start their balloting process. Although the analysis of each board's respective due process is done separately, the final standard will be a joint standard, and the boards will be asked to approve for publication the substantially same draft standard at the same time. Paragraphs 3 to 6 of the paper describe the addition of the project to the joint IASB and FASB agenda. Paragraphs 7 to 12 detail compliance with mandatory due process steps, namely the publication of due process documents, consideration of comments, and reports to IFRS Foundation bodies. Paragraphs 13 to 23 describe compliance with other non-mandatory due process steps. The outreach activities described are divided into three main categories: public hearings to raise awareness of the proposals, work with consultative and specialist advisory groups to ensure the proposals are clear and complete, and field work to improve, for example, the ISB's understanding of issues raised by the proposals. Paragraphs 24 and 25 go a little deeper and acknowledge the extra work the board and staff have done to address issues that developed regarding specific topics and industries over the course of the project. The staff do not think that the revisions to the proposed revenue standard include fundamental changes on which respondents have not had the opportunity to comment. The staff think that the revisions to the 2011 ED respond to the feedback received and that it is unlikely that re-exposure will reveal any new concerns. The staff recommend that the board do not re-expose the proposed revenue standard for a fourth round of public comment. Except for sweep issues, which may arise during the drafting stages of the balloting process, similar to the topic to be discussed at tomorrow's meeting, the ISB has now completed redeliberations and all mandatory due process steps required so far. As such, the staff think that the ISB is ready to prepare the final IFRS for balloting. At this time, the staff would also like to note that the decisions on most issues discussed by the board were tentatively approved by a majority of the members. However, any ISB members who intend to dissent to the IFRS are required to make that intention known at this time.
Okay, so first, who would like to re-expose this standard?
You.
Nobody? Oh, Philippe.
No, it's timing issue. I mean, I feel happy to say no, don't re-expose, yes, permission to ballot, and no dissent, that's clear. But I feel a bit at risk because we do that a week or two before FASB. And this is a joint standard. Now, let's assume, worst case scenario, that our friends decide to re-expose. What do we do then?
Listen, we are not going to get into this what if.
No, it's unfortunate that we don't take those decisions at the same time together, all together.
No, I don't think so.
Okay, let's take our risk then.
answered yes to all questions.
So who would like to re-expose? Nobody. So we do not want to re-expose.
Good.
Do we give permission to ballot?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. And who would like to dissent?
Good.
Some are voluntary dissent. We needed
dissent.
We needed dissent.
Can I make a joke? In three scenarios, let's assume FSB decide to re-expose. Should we re-discuss?
Well, I'll say no.
That all presumes, right, that there's going to be no more changes, right?
Well, we have one more paper, which is
subject to
education
paper,
and that's paper 7A, which Mary will tee up.
Yes. This is paper 7A, and this paper considers, feedback from the 2011 ED regarding how the revenue model would apply to credit card reward programs. Specifically, some preparers in the financial services industry were uncertain whether the boards intended the revenue model to apply to credit card reward programs, based in part on example 24 that was included in the 2011 ED. That was the example that dealt with a relatively simple credit card, a relatively simple reward program in the context of a retailer. The paper provides an overview of the type of transactions we're considering in paragraphs 5 to 10, as well as the current guidance that's applied under IFRS and US GAAP. Also, we've included that example 24 as an appendix to the paper. I think in the paper we lay out two possible paths that we think there are for the boards, the one being that the boards try and provide some more specific guidance on credit card reward programs, which we've described as alternative A in the paper. The other path is that we think boards let entities rely on the principles and the model, and we make a minor clarification that example 24 is not meant to be the definitive guidance for all credit card arrangements. We run through those two alternatives in detail in the paper in paragraphs 24 to 32. Now, this wasn't an easy issue to look at, I think primarily because the arrangements can be very complex and varied, and there's quite a lot of interaction there with FI. Just in saying that, when we had the FASB board meeting, that became apparent because it seemed like different FASB board members were coming up with different fact patterns, and what if this was the case, and there was quite a lot of discussion around the FIP. So I think it just reinforced why we think this is a very, very complex issue to try and deal with. So the staff are proposing alternative B as the most appropriate alternative, because we think that the 2011 ED already provides all the tools that an entity would need to address these types of transactions, and that trying to look at this in any more specific detail at this stage of the project might actually result in unintended consequences for other industries or transactions. I think we did note that much of the respondent feedback in terms of the concern was around that example 24, specifically that this example implied that, you know, this was the definitive guidance and all credit card points are always going to be performance obligations. So that's why we're recommending that clarification to example 24, just to maybe say, look, this is a simple situation, but if you're in the more complicated reward program, so for example, if there are more than two parties, you would have to look very carefully at the model in specifically trying to determine who you think the customer is in the transaction. Now, just again, maybe a little bit more extra in terms of the FASB ed session, which we've already had. I think there was a feeling, we got the impression that some of the FASB board members were hoping there was possibly a way to maybe land somewhere in between providing much more specific guidance, but maybe do a little bit more than what we were proposing as the staff recommendation. So possibly including something maybe in the application guidance or the IG that would just provide someone with a bit more in terms of how you would apply the tools to try and work through one of these arrangements without maybe necessarily saying what the answer was in a specific type of fact pattern. So as Hans said, this is the ed session, so we're not going to, you know, to answer the questions here, but the questions we're going to ask tomorrow are whether or not the boards agree that the 2011 ED already provides the principles that an entity would need to answer this type of question, and that they agree with the staff recommendation that we don't provide any more specific guidance, but possibly just tweak example 24 to make it clear that it's not the definitive guidance for more complicated reward programs. But I'll turn it over to the board.
Pat?
Gary, I'm kind of leaning more towards where I think the FASB is on this, only because I think it's not going to require an awful lot of effort. I think there's a significant payoff. And I was thinking about the language in paragraphs 30 A and B. When I read it, I appreciated where the ISB staff was coming from and generally didn't want to necessarily make wholesale changes, but I thought even some of the words like the last sentence in paragraph 30A, in cases where the link between the merchant and issuing bank is only indirect through network association, this might indicate the card's issuer's customers is the cardholder. That kind of puts more flavor, I think, around the discussion. Likewise, the last sentence in paragraph 30B, I won't read it. I think that's constructive. If this is going to eliminate future interpretations, or frankly, you know, going to lead to, if we don't do it now, it's going to lead to a question that this potentially new group that we're going to form is going to have to deal with. Why don't we just deal with it now and put it in there and flesh it out, put a little bit more flesh on the bone.
Patricia?
This paper seems to focus on whether there's enough guidance for the card issuer. And IFRIC 13, I always felt, dealt primarily with what the merchant should do. How does the staff feel? Does the staff think there's sufficient guidance in the draft standard around what the merchant should do? So let's say going through the guidance for the card issuer, it's clear that the card issuer is acting as agent. Does the merchant then know what it's supposed to do? Is there something that tells the merchant it should be thinking about whether the cardholder is acting as its agent? So it reports its revenue, presumably net. Is that clear to you?
That's a really good question. Maybe I'll make 2 points on that. I guess the one is that we didn't get an overwhelming amount of feedback from merchants saying we're not sure in these arrangements whether or not we have a performance obligation, whether or not we should do something. So you're right, the paper doesn't focus at all on what the accounting for the merchant should be. I think in terms of whether or not the model has sufficiently addresses this, I think personally that I think we have got enough in there because it would all come down to what the merchant thinks their performance obligations are when they enter into a contract with the bank. So it may be that when someone swipes their card, you'd say, well, what are my promises in that arrangement? And the one might be to deliver my goods, but I might have a second promise, which is to provide these points via the bank to the ultimate, you know, customer. So I'd hope that the people would be applying the model and get to that answer in cases where from an IFRIC 13 point of view, you would have concluded that the merchant actually had a liability for the points. We would say, well, in that case, if you applied the new model, you'd say you had a performance obligation for those points.
I don't think my question is about whether or not they have a performance obligation, because I think whether the card issuer is acting as an agent or a principal with the merchant, that the merchant ends up with a performance obligation. The question is whether they end up with revenue gross or net.
Well, again, I think that would lead to, we've got the guidance on agent principle, and I think it would be identifying what you think your promise, what have you actually promised in that arrangement? Have you promised to provide an agency type service, or have you promised to stand ready to provide the underlying service?
Thank you. If we adopt alternative A, then what is your expected guidance after all working studying all issues of this transaction?
Well, I think if that was a route that the board wanted to go down, we would maybe need a bit more time to analyze that, to come back with a couple of more detailed fact patterns and try and see whether or not the boards could get to a point where they could actually specify what the accounting
is. I have to say it like this one. Do you have any additional do you think we can develop additional guidance then in addition to the current requirement? That's what I'm saying, you know, if we can handle this transaction with the current, maybe the current revenue draft or requirements, and we don't expect any additional guidance, just we can make another example, then we don't have to do that, I guess, you know. We don't develop any guidance more than So that's why I'm saying, you know, if you just are using the alternative A, then is a what do you expect? If just to make another example, that's not a good way to do this.
No, I don't think so, because I think A, it would be very difficult to choose what that example is going to be, because I think if you think that we had example 24, which wasn't even dealing with credit cards specifically, and I think these folks drew analogies to that and said, oh, well, does that mean that even though I've analyzed it under the model differently, you're telling me that this is a PO? If we have a very specific fact pattern on credit card arrangements, I think even if we try and say this is very specific and, you know, if your fact pattern is slightly different, you might get a different answer, I think based on the responses that came back, it would be even harder for entities to say, well, I think that I'm in a different position for the following reasons. So my worry is we could end up doing more harm than good because we would shoebox everyone into doing one thing for a credit card arrangement when I think these arrangements can be quite varied and complex.
Daryl?
I sort of agree with what Gary just said. The answer there. I just think that there are so many variations of credit agreements, or credit card agreements, that once we start getting into the space, we're going to have a whole lot of requests. But I also just wanted to clarify what Pat was saying in the context of what Patricia was saying. If I understand what Pat's saying, we wouldn't give an example or any specific guidance. We'd simply say, look at the following five things. Once we do that, how many other potential few things do we have to provide guidance for? Because it feels to me like we're then opening up to anybody who sends us a letter in the next 2 weeks is going to have to get some kind of response. And I'm just concerned that if we think the model works for this one, it feels to me like, and you've already had, I mean, already from Patricia, there's a question based on something that came out of this. I think people need to work through the model and come to the answer that they think works, and I don't think we should be going over the top with advice.
Okay.
You know, the interesting thing is that the respondent who specifically asked for this was afraid that perhaps we are going down in one particular route. That's why they brought this issue. And I understand why staff brought this issue, but I think if we want to bring this issue and go into depth, there are 100 other issues we can bring it with the same amount of need. And I respect why staff brought it, and I have sympathies why staff brought it. But this particular issuer is very comfortable with the accounting they want to get to. And they are not looking specifically for it except for modifying this particular example. They didn't want anybody to wrongly infer to, is it example 24 or something like that? They didn't want us to refer to example 24. But if you really go down of trying to analyze this, there would be so many alleys that we need to go through. And I think it will be very dangerous to go through the staff's are some people saying that they would like to flush this and put some more meat on the bones? I think that the danger is that it will be result in a lot of change in the practice, which they have concluded, and I don't want to get into that. But I think we got to be careful in trying to ask staff to go and hunt. There's not much to hunt here. But the question is that then they will, if you go down the alternative A, there will be 200 other things. So like, you know, we got General Motors asking us to do some more work on this customer and insignificant performance obligation. That's on the table. Then we will sit here for another 6 months and trying to...
12 months.
12? Okay. Okay. Sorry. So I really think, I certainly believe that... both the parties, 95% of the world's transactions go through in one way in an open loop transaction, and only 5% of the world's transactions in terms of credit cards go through this closed loop. And both the parties, honestly, if you go and ask, and I had the privilege of talking to both of them, are very comfortable in accounting the way they account under the literature. We don't need to put anything to them because they're comfortable with what they have. Am I right, Gary?
The only answer you can give is yes.
Yes, yes. Yes. Of course, boss.
Yes, as always. Yes, as always.
Okay. So everybody is happy. I don't think we need to get into the deep waters here.
Okay. No more questions?
No.
Okay. Thank you. So this brings us to the close of today's discussions.